Leo Vegas her. Hos os kan du altid slippe din indre løve fri og få mere spænding i hverdagen. Leo Vegas Sport & Casino. Spænding her og nu. 18 plus. Spil ansvarligt.
Hello everyone and welcome to Never AFK episode number 100. I'm speaking English because this is an English episode. And come on, you guys understand English, I am sure. So, first of all, this episode was taped once again in the castle in Poland that you might recognize from the game design and the experience economy episode. Every year I go to a conference about experience economy. Google it if you're curious. College of Extraordinary Experiences. Now, these last couple of years, I've had a ton of amazing computer game conversations with a guy named Joseph. And so this year, I was like, man, I want to tape some of this and make it into an episode. And then I got joined by Steve, who a very, very humble Australian. When I say humble Australian, it's because when I ask him to introduce himself, he goes, oh, you know, I'm a massive gamer, and yeah, I'm a medical doctor, something, something surgery. And then 2 days later at the conference, Steve gets announced as one of the speakers as being somehow involved with the Australian space program. So, I am completely humbled and very, very, very happy to have these two amazing, wonderful human beings in my podcast episode number 100. This is the 100th episode. We have made 100 episodes of this thing. So I just wanted to, before we get into it, just wanted to take the time to say thank you, guys. If you didn't listen, this couldn't work. So thank you, thank you, thank you for your support throughout from episode one to now. We're going to keep going. As long as you keep listening, I'm going to keep going. Special shout out to the wonderful people who support us financially on tia.dk. Because if it hadn't been for you guys, I probably wouldn't have spent this amount of resources putting this thing together. So thank you, thank you, thank you so much. Special shout out to our gremlin, our producer, our main man Jonas, who helped us start off the entire shebang. And thank you to all of my wonderful guests who have helped contribute with doing this thing. And thank you guys for listening in. I would like to take over the world by the means of this podcast, and the easiest way to do it is get more listeners. So if you want to support us, me, this, whatever, spread the word. If you're gamers, you have gamer friends. If you have gamer friends who enjoy podcasts, pitch this and see if it might be something for them. Thank you guys so much. It has been an absolute honor and a treat, and we are not done yet. And now, the moment you have all been waiting for, episode number 100. A Danishman, a Scotsman. I should have written this down, shouldn't I? All right, a Dane, an Australian, and an Austrian walk into a castle. Take it away.
So there does need to be at least some degree of disclaimer of, yes, I'm a doctor, I'm not your doctor, this is not medical advice.
No. See? Like, I don't know if we're going to get into, like, talking about medicine.
Okay, sure.
The thing is, this is, I do a podcast about gaming. Mm-hmm. And 2 years ago, I had a fantastic conversation right here with Christy Cleland and Rick Briggs talking about game design and the experience economy. And then during these last couple of years, I have really enjoyed hanging out and geeking out about video games with you, Joseph. I feel humbled when I do, because you're fucking like it's basically, I just want this podcast to be
all the conversations we've had, but actually taped and shared with the world. And then I had a thing with you last night where I was like, hey, there's another video game geek here. Drop it in. Let's see what happens. And we've started, by the way. I don't fuck around. might as well get the ball rolling, get the thing going, right? So, Josef, if we could start with you.
Sure.
Maybe get you a step
I'll get
down.
Get closer.
Yeah. To make sure. Now, my listeners are very used to what can we call it? Fluctuating sound quality.
Ah, okay.
So, they're. Mainly Danish, it's a Danish podcast, but if you play computer games, you speak English. So don't get self-conscious, don't anything. Josef.
Okay, thank you. Yes, my name is Josef Schinwald. I'm from Austria. I teach game design at the University of Applied Sciences in Salzburg. And I was trained visual effects artist. And I think 15 years ago, I realized that I love visual effects, but I love games a lot more than visual effects, so I turned my interest towards that topic and implemented it in our university, and now we have a pretty solid game design, game development program running that produces very nice and very interesting games every year.
Nice, and that's why I'm humbled, because you meet people and you geek out about computer games and have you played this thing, and then you pitch and you do all things. But every time Josef pitches something, I played this amazing game, and you feel the passion and the geekiness, but then you kind of tag it with, oh yeah, and then I applied this at my took this game and applied it to my students at a university level master's degree. So it's the conversation every gamer has when you discover another gamer in a group, and you're like, tribe,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it's that with a kicker, and then I connected with you last night. Yeah.
So my name is Steve. I'm from Australia.
Last name, please, so we can properly.
Oh, so my name is Stephen Hicks. I'm from Australia. I've got a very varied and odd and different career path. My first line of work was working in electronic engineering many years ago, and currently, I work in medicine, mainly in weight loss surgery, and also I teach as a senior lecturer fundamental surgical skills to young doctors who want to become a surgeon.
So where do the games enter the picture?
I am a mad avid gamer, so, Counter-Strike 1.4.
There we go.
I was an early adopter of VR when Oculus first started running their Kickstarter. And I've got a number of friends in Australia who are passionate about using virtual reality for gamification of complex skill acquisition. So,
nice.
Using games to teach surgery concepts, using games to teach aviation concepts. That someone goes in to have a bucks party, and they come out being able to not realizing they have the fundamental skills for keyhole surgery. It's why does it need to be hard when it can be fun?
Damn. Well, there we go. So I guess that sets the scene. Josef, can you? Because when we talk, we just do this gaming thing where we keep pitching and we're like, oh, send me the link to that. Oh, fuck this up. Yeah. Oh, that sounds cool. But I want to dig a little here now that we have the time.
Yes.
Can you just start talking about how gaming and high level academical sciences kind of.
I have a hard time with the idea of high level academic sciences. I think
when you say the University of Applied Sciences, it's all like, all right, this is not just a guy playing Fortnite in his basement. Something's up.
At least not all the time. The idea, I think. First of all, University of Applied Sciences, are there or were created to cater to the industry. So our mission statement basically is to take in this, those students, and my, let's expand it to my personal mission statement, and take those, the dreams those students have when they apply for the program, and help them make it true. And the dreams are, I want to work as a character animator at Blizzard. I want to do independent games as a game designer, and I want to use games to get across a message that I that wouldn't be as powerful otherwise. Or I want to work at Pixar. So there is always those dreams, and that is what we're there for. And I think then it's the next step to say, okay, we really want those students to work on those things they dream of, is the logical next step. And that is what the University of Applied Sciences is, in my opinion at least, is there for. And that is the approach we take. We're very fortunate that we have two programs at our university. One is called Multimedia, where I work, and our sister program called Multimedia Technology. And the multimedia art side of things covers sort of all the aspects of media production, from film to audio to animation to media design. And the multimedia technology side has web and communities, AR, VR, and games. And the bridge between those programs is game design. So we have the core skills in programming, core skills in content creation, and bridge that together with the game design class, which is teaching rule sets, how to design rules, how to design features, how the production workflow works. But we're not about teaching Unity or Maya at this point. We're really thinking about what the game should be, how it should work, the mechanics. And that is a very nice bridge because students from both sides and from both programs get together there. And I don't care where they're coming from at this point. They're all game designers. And if their background is programming, great. If their background is animation or sound design, also great. I really think that it's a skill that is very helpful, even if you go in there and be a sound designer at the end. If you know about game design and you're working at a game company as a sound designer or as an animation artist, we had lots of students that sort of entered the industry on the content and programming side, but when the company realized they have an idea of what game design is all about and what's important, they transitioned into that area. So it's sort of an additional skill you get that helps you when you get out in the industry to be more flexible. Mm. So that is our approach, and yes.
Having you say that makes me think. I sometimes get the question when I do stand up. Mm-hmm. I sometimes get the question, can you enjoy stand up?
Yourself.
Myself.
Yes.
And I was kind of thinking that that might be a worthwhile question to you.
Okay. I enjoy stand up a lot.
but like, I believe that because I know the nuts and bolts and the tools of the trade, that I enjoy good stand up even more. And I can quicker see the gaps of where the expertise is lacking. Mm-hmm. Do you feel the same about video games? Because when I talk to you, it's like...
Fortunately enough, no. I don't have a problem. I couldn't distance myself as a visual effects artist. So watching a Marvel movie is great, but I can't stop the analyzing part where I see wireframes and see what's going on the visual effects side. So that is a little a small problem for the enjoyment. With games, I don't have that problem at all. I think I have such a deep love for the medium and for the experiences you get that even if they're flawed, there's always something in there that's interesting, that's challenging, or yeah, in some games, even transformative.
Do you bounce that over to you then, yeah. Steve? Like, you work with gamification. Mm. Does that affect, and then you geek out when you're like in your own space?
Yeah. So anyone who has a background in programming, I'm sure will resonate with this, that you're using an application or a menu system or a piece of software, and you can see what the engineer or programmer had been trained in and what they were trying to do, but they didn't pull it off. Or even worse, they did it perfectly from a 90s software architecture mindset, mm-hmm. that you go, I know what you're trying to do, but no. That's something that
Can't you also, like, sometimes just go, yes?
Yes. When it's done well, you get to sell it, like, you almost feel like you're celebrating with the original programmer or designer.
Yeah. Yes.
That you can see, like, you can't see the storyboard, you feel the journey. That is a disconnect between, gamification of training, that is difficult because so much at the moment is just based on drills. Literally the same as someone who's in the army, you know, you stand to attention, this is how you march, this is how you perform this task. And we're currently reaching the bridge between synthetic training of it is simply an electronic procedural drill that you're running through again and again and again before you try it on a live tissue model or in a laboratory or in a surgical theatre. But there's no engagement entertainment. That it's a simulation in the worst sense rather than a simulation in the best sense.
Can you exemplify with, like, which games do you play that make you feel either way or another? Like, give me names here. Or think about it.
Just an extension to it. Because I have the feeling with games that there is often ambition over execution.
Which game do you feel that?
There is, like, one of the recent games where I thought this could have been... I don't want to be unfair. Often it's a question of resources. Mm. But for instance, games
and subjective. With all the disclaimers.
Yeah. So the Gothic games, for instance, were very ambitious German huge open world games, but yeah, they stumbled on execution. They're not that big of a team, but still, I enjoyed them a lot. Mm. But you could feel it in the course. Yeah. It's not a BioWare game.
Was Pillars of Eternity German?
Pillars of Eternity, I think, is Obsidian. I'm not sure.
One game that has completely dragged me down the rabbit hole, and I think my Steam account is saying that I've got several hundred hours in this game now.
Steam account counter.
Oh, it's the judgment. Like, it stares at me. So my wife is a gamer as well, so at least it's a comparison rather than criticism. A game that the idea of deliberate pacing, anticipation, working step by step to achieve, and having that feeling of threat, risk, reward, safety.
Yes.
I won't articulate it very well, but I found that is a very useful skill set, especially in areas of medicine, for what is your psychological management, how are you self-managing in a work environment. This game has completely sucked me in for the last 2 or 3 years, called The Long Dark by Hinterland. I believe it's an indie-produced game. I'm pretty sure it was Kickstarted to begin with. Very, very simple concept that was executed well. It's a sandbox game, open world, like Rust or The Forest, but there are no zombies, there are no dragons. What has happened? You're a pilot and you're flying through Far North Canada. There is a flash of aurora and the world's electronics switch off in a silent apocalypse. So you crash land, you have no electronics, you're on an island off the coast of Canada. It is cold, it is dark, there are wolves. Find food, find water, go from there.
Yeah.
Which, for a game that has the risk and reward, like threat, life and death, the first time you get attacked by a wolf, like, you almost, like, almost fell out of my chair. But it's a game that is positive and strive towards the psychological mentality of survival, of hope and success.
Mm-hmm.
That's a mental skill set that in my occupation atrophies over time.
Atrophies?
Withers.
Okay, gotcha.
Yep. For a lot of my colleagues, work is...
Guys? Hey, guys. We're taping something here.
Yeah. Sorry.
Sorry.
Do you need to come past?
It's kind of Don't have any accidents.
Yeah.
You really have something to tape.
The worst decisions lead to the best anecdotes, right?
Sorry.
So, the long dark.
The long dark. For the idea of mental attitude for survival, which you gentlemen are European, I'm assuming you've done some type of military training or service, that attitude and that mentality, and that is the difference between it being the worst 4 months of your life or being something that is a growth experience. A number of my friends use these kind of games, that it is an adversity but with a positive mindset, and with a there is no completion, but you can continue to succeed, as a excellent avenue for self-care.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it's cool. that's one game that I'd say the execution outshone its expectations.
Can we dwell on that for a second? That's deep.
Mm.
Like, there is no completion, but continuing to succeed.
Mm.
That's life.
Mm.
Right? You don't, like, when you everybody has obstacles and shit.
Joseph, you look skeptical.
Wow, it's a tall order, and something I probably won't be able to really comment on in a qualified way.
Please,
quickly.
Shh. Taping stuff. So,
I mean, if you think about games as a service, I think the whole idea behind that sort of resembles that concept, that there is no ending, but this continuing sense of accomplishment and fun and engagement. So when we watch throughout the last few years what happened in the industry for the big players, I mean, we have people here from Ubisoft, who Ubisoft is probably the prime example of how to turn like singular experiences into something ongoing that lasts for hundreds of hours.
Wait a minute, we have someone here from Ubisoft.
Yeah, David Kennedy, game director from Ubisoft. I forgot we should have brought David in.
All right, cancel everything. We're going to get
reporting. Getting David. These two guys are all I'm going to bring.
Yeah.
So yeah, I see this. I haven't played The Long Dark, so I can't really comment on that.
I think that's the first time every other game I've like, so have you played Inside? So have you?
And to be honest, I when it comes to personal preferences, I personally have a hard time with survival simulations like Scum, like Forest, like Rust. I think just because of the reason you enjoy it, like the long time you can invest, I've fallen into these holes. And like World of Warcraft for 1.5 years, Heroes of the Storm for over a year, and they become pretty exclusive at that point. Mm. And every time I sort of got out of that, I don't want to say addiction, but that passion, I felt a little bit sorry for all the games that I've missed in that time. So, as a self-protection, I'm trying to stay away from. On the other hand, I think like 400 hours into Skyrim. To be honest, 150 of those hours went into modding Skyrim.
And the last 100 hours went into fucking smithing iron damage.
Bang, bang, bang.
Grind it, baby.
Yeah. Like the first time I found the... Here, read this book. Here's Smithing 100. No, actually play the game mod. Because, you know, you geek out about... Skyrim was my... for the time it came out, Skyrim was the game where I had the idea that the developers had been sitting in their basement with a large poster of me on the wall. And every 15 minutes they do, stop everything, just checking in. Are we still doing exactly what this guy wants? Right?
Did you go out and then learn how to blacksmith?
I started that the other way around.
Right.
Because I'm an old school LARPer, and once at a medieval fair.
Outstanding.
So you already knew blacksmithing?
Well, no. I spent a weekend under very careful supervision with a guy who knew what he was doing, and I made a little bitty knife that took 12 hours to make.
Oh, nice. Very cool.
But that was fun.
Yeah.
Because that you actually produced. I think that grindy experience was the only thing about Skyrim that kind of.
Don't underestimate the catharsis of having red hot iron and a hammer.
Working out
your frustration.
Yeah, in real life, it's amazing. Yeah. But when you're experiencing it, like when you're exploring the crafting system, when you're like, oh, wait a minute, so if I, oh, that makes, and then, oh, I can put a diamond in it to be, all right. Yeah. All of that stuff, that's funny.
Yeah.
That's explorative. But the vertical, okay, I'll sleep for 24 hours, so this guy has more iron bars I can buy, and then I'll have to do the thing to get the leather straps, and then I have to, because I discovered, which I believe is a design flaw of Skyrim, actually,
mm-hmm.
that you gain as much progress towards the next level of smithing by making iron dagger as you do by making a full plate Daedric armor. So of course, like, all right, I want a quest, I don't want to stand here, but they could have gamified that more somehow, right?
It's, when it feels like you're going from playing a game and immersing yourself in the game environment to, am I running a spreadsheet for a logistics back end of a delivery company?
Yeah, you go from FuzzRodar to Excel.
Yeah, right? Yeah, and it's when your game becomes a job. And I think that with what you're saying about falling into, especially the Mamorpagas, of you come up for breath a year and a half later and go, wait, what?
It's interesting to see if I watch my friends list on Discord. You can see that there are some people in there who have been playing, in my case, Heroes of the Storm for like 3 or 4 years now.
Mm.
And I see them almost every evening. So there is this intense quality to those games, and I completely understand why games like League and Dota became so huge, because it's so satisfying. And the cooperative and competitive component come together in such a beautiful way that it is extremely engaging.
I distance myself from those kind of games just because I'm not a fan of PvP.
Mm-hmm.
I used to play a lot of Killing Floor as a first-person shooter.
Yeah.
If it's not a headshot, you're wasting ammo. And until they came out with a few years ago, they came out with a mod that fixed it, but you'd get griefers who are just, and if I'm not playing with people close enough, I can throw a boot at them and tell them, stop being a dick.
Yeah.
Then it's like, give me a campaign instead.
Okay, all right, so I play League of Legends, and I've played for like 3-4 years, maybe started season 6. Yeah, maybe I've played for 3 years. And it took me, like, this is, I think, last month, I finally was like, you know what? Fuck this shit. Remove the chat. Just go into the options and go, chat is now no longer a part of this.
Mm.
I don't want to blame anyone, and I don't want to have to validate my own decisions.
Mm.
Let's just play the game.
Yep.
And I should have done that after a week of starting. Like, because, of course, when you play with your friends and it's competitive and you get into the whole cooperation thing, and then you can lose together and have fun, like, hey, what the fuck was that, man? Oh, man, sorry, I didn't know his flash was up, whatever, blah, 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 blah. But when you play with someone on the other side of the internet, they don't have the background calculations that made you make a decision.
Yeah.
They just see you make a decision that didn't turn out well.
Mm.
You started Baron, you didn't have a smite. Yeah, but I saw his, but you suck.
Mm.
But I'm like, yeah, I saw their junker on the other side of the map, and I thought, okay, 4v5, that could be something, right? But so just eliminating, like, all of that. Unless I play with people I like.
And there are studies about what creates toxicity in multiplayer environments. And number one setup for toxicity is competitive play against strangers.
Yes.
Yep.
And the lowest toxicity, I would say there is no toxicity, is cooperative play with friends.
Yeah.
So there that's exactly what I say. Okay, then I can, like, say, what the hell? Why throw the flashbang in front of my face right now? And have that in chat or on voice chat, but still have this camaraderie about it and not feel like having to teabag someone.
What? Why is this not uniformly known?
I think it is within the game development community that.
But the game
cooperative gameplay is an extremely good way to engage players and form bonds. And
but I'm just thinking, but like we've done a lot of episodes on toxicity and what all that does. But like, if that's actually a point that I feel is beyond the world of gaming, mm-hmm. is that in any shape or form, be it sustainability or social issues or like all of this, there are studies that have found the solution or but it doesn't translate into the end user somehow.
You'd be able to comment much more with a degree of authority on this. I was listening to a podcast, I think it was on the Tim Ferriss Show, where a podcaster was talking about feedback that comes to him when he releases an episode or writes a blog.
Who is he again?
I can't remember the which interview I was listening to, but it was someone being interviewed on the Tim Ferriss Show.
Who's Tim Ferriss? For those who don't know.
Tim Ferriss wrote the 4-Hour Work Week.
Oh!
Yeah. He's a eclectic, dissident, subversive, entrepreneurial. He's a strange person. One of our people.
Yeah.
So in this interview, this blogger or podcaster, I can't remember the context, said that he has a habit of when he goes through the correspondence, he'll actually start responding like, an email came through saying, "Dude, you're full of shit. You don't know what you're talking about. Why the hell did you say that? You know, you need to get a clue." And so he actually will email back saying, "Oh, I'm really sorry you don't agree. Could you expand a bit more on how you think I should present that differently?" And the replies that he gets from that is, "Oh, I really didn't think you'd read this." That there seems to be an element of people sending this negativity out into the world, whether it's disenfranchised teenage gamers who that's how they get their rage, like they hate school, that's how they get the rage out, or frustrated professionals or people who are just dicks maybe at times.
But it's easier to be a dick to someone you don't know,
exactly,
well, someone you don't see, right?
Yeah, you're a 6-foot-tall Viking. Versus if we're on Dota, I can start throwing any number of slags and slurs at you and go like, "Yeah, what are you going to do, man? Yeah. I'm in Australia." if we're in the same room, then I'm probably going to get one of your size 12 boots thrown at my head.
Every humans want to connect. Humans want to like have community, and so it's not only I fear of the physical repercussions. Mm. It's also I actually kind of want you to like me, because that's gonna make this social setting we're in a lot easier.
Any attention is good attention,
right?
Yeah. But I want to come back for a moment to the idea of how does this affect our world, or on a more general scale, and that is one of the reasons why I think so highly of games. There is this, I think it's now 5-year-old, this book by Jane McGonigal, an American researcher, called Reality is Broken, which is quite famous. And the idea behind it is basically we're not playing enough games. And if we look at the theory, how does a human become really, really good at something? You have to put in time. Mm. So if you want to be the best violin player in the world, you start at the kid's age, and you play until you,
Like the rule of 10,000 hours.
Exactly, like the rule of 10,000 hours. Yeah. So what we have now is millions and millions of young people who are really, really good at video games. And one of the arguments is video gamers have one big advantage over people who don't play video games, and that is every problem we're faced with, we think of solvable, because there is no unsolvable problem in a game. So if that becomes a deep mindset, then there is nothing that can't be solved. And video game players can't help to take this mentality into real life and think, okay, but there has to be a solution. We can't let it stay like that. Mm. There's always an option to go. And that is one of the ideas behind the book, that if we would spend, or humanity would spend more games, more time playing video games, we would have a more solid baseline of this acceptance that hunger, world hunger, save it. We just need to do this, and we're there. Sort of, that's like the pink glasses version of that, where we think, and that is probably one of the things that the criticisms of the book, that it's a little too shiny, pink. Happy people in pink. But nevertheless, I like it because I believe in some of the ideas, and I believe that interactivity gives you meaning in a way. You can watch documentaries, you can read books about a topic, but experience it firsthand as first approximation in a video game or even in a LARP, which would be more powerful, transforms your mindset and gives you an experience you remember as having lived through something as opposed to having watched or listened or read something.
But when you say that, I immediately think of Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice.
Yeah.
Which was, it's a first-person action puzzle, kind of like Darksiders.
And third-person, yeah.
Yeah. That was developed with, I'm not completely sure, but either people who work with people with mental disabilities or people with mental disabilities,
they
right?
work with people with psychosis.
Psychosis and you know, hearing voices. Mm. And the hearing voices, so Senua is the fighter fantasy thing, and she hears voices. And they really tried to put into the game what that, and then they made it a part of the combat system.
Right.
That you'd get like a watch out.
Yeah.
And when you heard watch out, something is coming at you from the back.
And it's all binaural sound as well, so it's moving around.
And you hear it from the right, and you're instantly like,
That from a medicalized mental health perspective. What if someone was playing that, and or if it was in a stand up, like a stationary VR perspective, psychiatrically naive civilians watching that and seeing someone suddenly react as a tool for this is what your loved one, this is what your family member, this is what they experience when they hear a voice. For them, it is real. It is the truth of God. This is profound, and so they react. To us, it looks bizarre or wrong or destructive, but for them, this is a reality that they have to live with.
And if we saw a documentary on people who heard voices, we'd be like, but now we are hearing the voices, and that just internalizes the whole thing.
Yeah. With what you were talking before about the gamer concept of every problem can be solvable.
Yeah.
Ignoring some awful dating experiences where I tried to grind any system.
Oh, yeah. This does not work with romance.
It's not. No.
Gaming every problem can be solved is the worst thing you could ever do in any type of like relationship.
You do get achievement unlocked, restraining order. I've got a number of... I'm very fortunate to work and teach and mentor very passionate, driven, highly educated, motivated young people who then slowly get ground down and crushed either through the corporate model of medicine or friends that have gone into industry and that they go into law wanting to change the world and they end up being a financial analyst working in a back office. And the only thing that brings them hope in their lives is that at home in a garage, there's a Ferrari that they never get to drive. A particular friend springs to mind who, promising, creative, quite a clever person, who moved into a corporate job and then would work in a job that made them miserable and retreat into World of Warcraft as their escapism, as their sense of accomplishment, sense of achievement. That continuation, I guess, the call to arms of you're part of the gamer society. No problem is unsolvable. If there was a Steam badge for solving world hunger, then it'd, you know, someone would grind that pretty fast. But the idea that they then start to replace aspects of their real life with their games. So in addiction, there's a theory that if someone is addicted to alcohol or heroin or food, which is that's an area of where I work, what pain did that substance treat? What comfort did that substance provide? Did drinking help you forget bad memories? Did certain drugs make you feel a sense of love or accomplishment or importance? Does eating make the sadness quieter? And it becomes addiction when the effects of your substance start to affect your real life. Mm-hmm. Games are incredibly therapeutic for a lot of people, but it's when it starts to move into that replacing your human relationships, mm-hmm. replacing your interaction in the world, replacing your creativity at work, that you grind a spreadsheet rather than thinking, hold on a minute, why do we do it this way? Mm.
I made one episode about the about addiction, video game addiction, mm-hmm. and I had two very, very brilliant people. One is a psychologist, and one I don't know his theoretical background, mm-hmm. but he knows his shit, right? Shout out to Christian and Ask and Johan. But the entire point of that was the whole there is no such thing as addiction. There is a lack of compassion and lack of connectivity and lack of so the people who get addicted are people who need a substance to replace something else that they're losing. What Christian says is there's been studies that if you take sound people, like mentally healthy, when you sit down and play video games, if you're a gamer, then your endorphin whatever curve spikes, mm. and then at some point it derails until that keeping sitting there will actually make you sadder or less than the baseline. And the time for this is, I believe, about 6 or 7 hours mm-hmm. a day. So, yes, there is a point where video games become too much. Mm. Totally. Mm. But that point is way further down than most parents would say, oh, you can have 2 hours.
I do agree with. It's and this is admittedly showing some of my background. I went to a LAN party for some younger friends of mine, which I'm not a fan of Dota, personally. They are. What really surprised me was that they'd play around. It takes, 30, 40 minutes? Mm. And then they'll talk about how cool it was for an hour.
Post-game analysis.
Not even that. It was like, hey, when I did that, that was really cool.
Yeah.
When you did that, that was really cool.
Yeah.
I kind of slunk into the corner and started playing Killing Floor. And someone came over and said, oh, you're being a bit antisocial, but this is a LAN party. We're here to game. You know, it's, oh, well, you know, we're still here for another hour or two. It's only 8 o'clock at night. Oh, yeah, every now and then we'll play till, you know, midnight or 2 a.m. or, dude, that's a Tuesday.
I was thinking about the idea of escapism because I'm a little bit critical about the discussion around it. Often in media, the escapism idea is presented in a way that I think is a little bit one-sided and biased. And there is something to be said for in favor of the concept that people escape their reality. And the word escapism came from Harry Houdini's escape shows, where he got rid of chains. That's the region where escapism. Then, when the Great Depression started, the term sort of took a turn and became that what we know, that fleeing your reality and going to the movies or shows and
LARPing or gaming
and I've read and I think it was a scientific paper by a Danish guy and his name was Frode Stensing. If he was from Savas, I'm very sorry, Mr. Stensing, but he wrote something quite interesting, that is the effect of where the motivation comes from for an activity the differentiation between self-suppression and self-expression. The paper is not related to video games at all, but it applies perfectly. And the question is why do I, when I get home from work, why do I start up the game I love and play it. Do I play it because I'm rewarding myself for I had a great day, I achieved something, it was good, and it's sort of a gift to myself, which would be self-expression, or is it something where I said I need the escapism? Yeah, I retreat myself. I don't want to see the world anymore. Get the fuck out of my life.
Or is it the story of the wow widow? Of you finish work and you come home to your second job of 4 hours of hunting boar skins or whatever. I agree that there's a very heavy focus on game, the criticism of gaming as escapism, especially from the view that it's a negative. Like that, escaping your pain rather than as a sense of reward. The same can be said for, you know, it's different media. Like, for me, I'd say that I achieve more escapism with books. So, yes, I'm an avid gamer and love getting into the story. In the same way as if there's a movie, it's I don't like people talking next to me. It's we are here to experience what we're seeing on the screen.
Yes.
Versus the Expanse series, the book series, like I have to tactically choose when I open the cover, because my wife knows that I'm going in and I'm not coming out till till it closes the other end. I think that the media that people use, the same can be said for music, same can be said for sailing or surfing, LARPing, kite surfing, anything, that it's the motivation behind it that creates it as a pathology or as a catharsis.
Yes.
Yeah. As a game designer, is there anything that you've found influencing or being able to try to guide it in one direction or the other?
Well, that's a tough one. One of the first sentences, one of the first messages I give to my students that they're taking on something that has huge responsibility. Because you are... in a spectrum between being a drug dealer and a priest, so someone who cares for your soul. And where you put your game on that spectrum is very, very difficult. But on one hand, you obviously want your players to enjoy your game because they paid for it. Yeah. You're there to give them something they enjoy. But then do you really then you have those screens in games where you say you've played for 2 hours, it's time to go out, which is like, is that the way to communicate that you should? I don't think that's the way. But still, there is this problem of where do I put myself? How do I put in? And you're designing these mechanisms at this point. So you're mixing the drug. And you're deciding to a certain degree how it will work with your audience. And then that's a completely separate discussion that as a game designer, it's hugely different than a movie director, where you put out the vision you have, and that's it. As a game designer, that is one of the hardest things for my students, for instance, to distance themselves from personal authorship. Obviously, you're responsible for authoring it, but you've always have to think about who it is on the other side who's going to play the game, what you trigger in them, how you keep them engaged and stuff like that. So that is something my students sometimes find hard, because most of them come in, or not most, that's not fair. Some of them come in with the idea of telling a story. And I think that's the wrong approach to games, but that's just my personal opinion. I think the most important thing is interactivity, then comes gameplay, then comes story. And you have to think of it in that order, I think.
Doesn't that depend on the gamer?
If you have someone who's very story... I have a pretty strong personal opinion about that. I think it's great to have cool stories in games, but I'd rather have a great gameplay than a great story, and then the other way around.
I'd also argue that with thorough engagement, so going back to The Long Dark, when it first came out, there was a half paragraph of story. That was it, and you created the narrative from there. And so some people, there's a journaling aspect to it, where if you want you can make notes, and I've not looked into it deeply, but some of the Reddit threads of how deep they dive into creating the world around their character as they explore, survive, perish, and try again. In education, it's a very old principle, but that a high school teacher is an entertainer first, and the students walk away having knowledge that they don't realize that they received. We've all been in lectures where it's chalk and talk, that the lecturer is talking to a blackboard with a screeching chalk over top, versus the engagement, the idea of if I tell you, you won't remember. If I show you, you might remember. If I engage you to do the act, then you will remember. And also building on what you're saying, that looking forward, how will games translate into our interpretation of modern culture? That at the moment, you could almost argue that games are a mirror or a lens looking at the world as it is today. 50, 100, 200 years from now, some of these games, how will they be seen as a simulation or a synthetic reality of the present day? With game designers, that sense of responsibility of these are now the storytellers, the magic man, the tribal medicine man. This is the equivalent of the oral history that's being passed on. And what message, what story are you portraying? Mm-hmm. Have you heard of Dave Grossman?
Yes.
Yes.
I haven't, and maybe some of my listeners haven't.
Sure. So Colonel Dave Grossman, I believe he is a, I think he was a Colonel of Marines, I believe, but US Armed Forces. He wrote a book called, it's the second book called On Combat. Now, the book is written as a model for preventative steps for PTSD. So he now works, in the book he talks about working as a, he will be deployed to a school where there's been a school shooting. He debriefed a lot of the first responders from the World Trade Center, and he works with a lot of veterans of PTSD, talking through their experience, and has developed various skill sets for inoculating someone for post-traumatic stress disorder when they're coming into a traumatic event, mitigation steps during the traumatic event, and then how to perform the debrief. So the first third of the book is discussing the problem. The final third of the book is giving stepwise how you the management skills and strategies. Some his breathing technique. I teach it to medical students, and it was originally developed in the military to help calm soldiers. Very effective. One of the stories I've heard is a 10-year-old child can have a broken arm set using just the breathing technique as their anesthetic. Very, very highly rated. Very effective. The middle third of the book is effectively him going on a rant about violent video games as being training simulators for school shootings.
Oh, man.
So I'm bastardizing it. I'm not doing a good job. But it's...
really?
So it's... Keep in mind... So I was an avid...
He sounded so cool. I was like, hey, man, I'm really into this guy.
He talks about the responsibility component of it, and also that a lot of the modern first-person shooters games that are coming in are based on the principles of military simulation for leading a target, threat assessment, target decisions, all this kind of stuff. I've got to say, I was a hardcore gamer the whole way through high school. The bloodier the better. And if you remember when Quake first came out, it was the first game to capture frenzy.
Mm.
Where you retreat with rocket jumping, and it's just... okay, I'm going to have to respawn, you know, when you come down from the buzz. He convinced me to a degree about being careful with your exposure of young people to interactive images of violence. Of course, it's you need to make your own decision, but it's something that especially as we move on to become... older members of society and looking at it from an education perspective, what are the messages, what are the images that we're putting out there? And even if they're the same, it's acknowledging where we fit in that delivery and that responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that a six-year-old should play Wolfenstein The New Order.
Of course not.
He actually explores through that of, well, what about, he talks about a case study of a father taking a five-year-old to see Saving Private Ryan, which with a neurodevelopmental stage of the child, for them what they see on the screen is actually physical reality.
Yes.
Where on the spectrum is it appropriate and responsible? In Australia we have the rating system.
Exactly.
So, M-M-A-R. And the number of parents who buy R-rated games for 10 and 12 year olds because it's seen as a game.
Exactly, that's the huge problem.
People don't see this as a form of literature or media.
And because it's a game, it's actually even more powerful.
Yeah,
right.
And I agree to a certain extent, and especially, but I think there is a pretty easy solution that's already, and you already mentioned it, that there is ESRB, PEGI, and so on. So if the parent would take a little more care about what their kids play, and I've had that in my personal life, that I've seen kids play GTA at 8 years old, and I stopped that, but I did it for a while, and I asked the parents, did you give him porn movies as well?
Yeah.
And they like, what the hell? And I said, well, both of them are for 18 years and above. So what's the difference?
But this is game. This is play. It's a toy.
Exactly.
And it's like, well, are you going to give a child a bayonet?
I'm going to play the devil's advocate just for a second.
Yeah, sure.
I completely, like, no, I'm not trying to front. Mm. Like, when your brain is developing and you haven't learned the difference between reality and facilitated reality, yeah, don't have your 8-year-olds play GTA.
Yeah.
Right. But I do think that society in general don't give kids enough credit for how smart they really are.
Can I, one sentence? Because I, yes, and that is why I would be a little more flexible, and that includes, again, parents really caring and really checking. If something, like, I have an 11-year-old daughter, and she plays Fortnite with all her friends, and I'm not sure, you have, but I think it's 12 or 14, the age restriction for
Good luck making that happen on a global scale. Yeah.
But the idea is that if you've got your feeling that your child is capable of reflecting and is like you have the your 10-year-old that's capable of feel like that she or he would be able to deal with something that is for appropriate for ages 12 or 14. There is this flexibility, but don't jump over from 10 to 18. I think there is wiggle room in that. Mm. But this wiggle room is the responsibility of the parents. And I've got a feeling that educating parents about that games are a medium like any other in terms of spectrum of messages. Mm. And there are adult games that are catering to themes that are interesting to adults. Mm. You're watching your thriller on TV. Mm. Why isn't and there are games that are catered to the same audience, you wouldn't want your kid to sit next to you when you're watching a thriller. So don't let them play the game that deals with the same topics and the same issues.
Yeah. Dear sirs, we have been talking for almost an hour.
Can I just add one last comment on that?
Sure. This isn't the last comment. Keep it, because you can add several.
Yeah.
But I am going to say that we need to, I'm not like pressing stop now, but we need to kind of maybe try to raise the bar. What's the word I'm looking for?
Wind it down.
Wind it down. Maybe tie a bow. Yeah. Like maybe finding a common denominator with the things we've been talking about.
So there will be some of your listeners who are sitting there quietly fuming, saying, "Don't you tell me how to raise my kids." So
probably, that's what my.
I'm speaking directly to them to see how many rage quit at this point. So all of us grew up in the TV culture, the babysitter.
Yeah.
That it's a putting them in front of the TV. It means that mum and dad get some quiet, like they can get on with what the logistical management of the house. We've been subjected to that, and we've also all performed that. iPads now are more pervasive for that.
Mm. Yeah.
Putting someone in front of a TV show, then you get 20, 45 minutes of quiet time to get the cooking done, to get the cleaning done, and the like. Now, putting them in front of a video game that engages them for 2, 4, 6 hours, I would go as far as to say, with what you're talking about, parental engagement, I feel that there is a generation of young people who their engagement, components of their nurturing is now coming from their sense of accomplishment in the games. That can be a very positive thing for the building of community, teamwork, working with strangers, The ethnic diversity available in gaming, I think, can be a very rich and strong thing. But it's when that is being used to substitute for home engagement, family engagement, personal engagement, that interaction with their parents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Playing Fortnite with your daughter would be one thing.
I do. Yeah, that's a very. It is a very cool way to connect over something that she enjoys usually, and me too, basically.
Versus I'm sorry, Daddy's busy. Yeah. Why don't you go play your game? Yeah. And then you get into work, and you suddenly realize it's 6 hours later. She hasn't had dinner. Mm-hmm. You haven't had dinner. You're both now like that gaming, that the fuzz, the burn, the cranky. And then, well, what's your next experience? Mm-hmm. How, as a parent, how are you curating the culture that your child is exposed to?
And I understand that as a parent, I completely understand that it's not that easy. Just like, first of all, nobody buys boxed video games anymore. So just turning the box and looking at the age restriction is not, it is a little more involved. I understand that. But I really think that the effort should be made, and it's not a huge effort to take a little insight and
taking an interest in
exactly that's the word I was looking for. Taking an interest in what your kids, and it is difficult because lots of parents aren't technologically as versed, so they can go into Steam, go into the shop site, look at the age restriction, stuff like that. But it sometimes helps just to look over the shoulder of the kid and see what's
going on.
You're
working as teaching developers. Is that also a responsibility of the developers to make it available?
What do you mean? The information?
I totally agree. The involvement of parents.
Yeah.
Is there also something? I remember, was it you talking about the monetization system of Fortnite?
Yes.
Where it was really like how well crafted it was, but without feeling
abusive.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, when your target group is the Fortnite target group, parental supervision is a thing, right? So, how much do you do to hide the microtransactions?
At this point, I think then, if the question is a little biased in itself, because there are obviously, we talked about Fortnite and the monetization, and there are good examples. I think Fortnite is a fair setup. You pretty much know what you're getting beforehand. It's for the amount of time that the game provides, the amount of content that's constantly changing. They've built a system where I say, okay, I'm fine with paying $10 for 2 or 2.5 months for my daughter, so she has more enjoyment of this game. So, but then there's other examples. In terms of responsibility for developers, I think if we talk monetization, obviously there is nefarious agendas going on there. If we talk protection for children, that's a way more difficult discussion.
Yes, no. But we've kind of extrapolated on that. So can we end this with a bombshell?
Wow, you know you.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Steve, go ahead.
Guys, I'm so sorry to drag you out of this. I could stay here for hours, but I'm just.
What do you mean by bombshell? End it with a bombshell.
Can we put this conversation into very few words? Games are good. Use them with care.
Our society is shaped by stories that we started. We have evolved from a based on an oral history tradition. We use stories for communication, for education, for enlightenment, for salvation. Games are our new stories. They are our new literature. And for the young people today, this is their classics. This is their books. This is the lessons that they're learning from. Yeah. What influences, what authors are you exposing this current generation to? And as authors and creators, what messages are you sending out into the world? And it doesn't mean, so the man who created a scalpel can also make a knife. Are they responsible for the application of those tools? Well, that's a very hard question. But how is this being curated in society? What is the context? How is this, we need to view games as our new literature and our new stories. And we need to have a responsibility as developers, but particularly we need to have a responsibility as consumers and who we pass this on to.
Boom!
Yeah, very good. I think there is nothing to add from my
Steve and Joseph, thank you so much. It has been an absolute treat. I'm sure this conversation will continue when we get drunk tonight and do all the things. But for now, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Der er lister, der aldrig får ende. Hvor meget udstyr kan budgettet mon spænde? En jungle af tilvalg og skjulte gebyrer. Drømmebilen bliver bare dyrere og dyrere. Vi ændrer din tvivl til kærlighed. Xpeng giver ro og ærlighed. Hos Xpeng er der ingen ekstra og plus. Du får det hele uden omveje og sus. Læs mere på xpeng.dk.